This episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast is brought to you by Zephyr CMS. It's a modern cloud-based CMS system that's licensed only to agencies. You can find them at zephyrcms.com. More about this later in the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is John Jantz and my guest today is Seth Godin. He's an entrepreneur, best-selling author, and speaker. In addition to launching one of the most popular and long-running and probably most posts ever blog, he's also written 19 best-selling books, including The Dip, Lynchpin, Purple Cow, Tribes. His latest is called This Is Marketing. And we're not going to talk about books today. We're going to talk about maybe everything but books, but I bet we talk about books. So,
thank you, sir. It's so generous for you to have me. By my calculations, it's the seventh time we've done this together. Actually, those are your calculations, but I'm trusting your judgment on this.
Well, look, I think the first interview was Meatball Sunday. So
that was a long time ago. It's been a wonderful journey to be able to live in a world where people like you and me can show up and narrate and teach and do it in a way that has this scale and impact. It's thrilling. It's hard to imagine where you and I would have been in 1724.
It is very hard to imagine. I imagine it would have been much more much more like manual labor.
I'm bad at manual labor.
So you, about 5 years ago, I think I may have lost track. You launched a podcast or jumped into podcasts. You call it Akimbo. Was that the first version, or did you kind of evolve that, or as it is today?
Well, my podcast history is that I did an early podcast, not as early as you. When I did a conference for a couple hundred people, I wanted to say to the people who couldn't come, look, I'll record it. So I did, and we turned that into a 14-episode podcast. And for a while, like more than a year, it was the number one business podcast in the world because there weren't any business podcasts. But I felt like I've been lucky enough to know some of the people from NPR. Krista Tippett is a dear friend of mine. And it took me years to get over the Krista I thought I knew from the radio to have an actual engagement with her. And I was wary of showing up in people's headphones every week. It's a form of intimacy that I wasn't really ready for. So I designed a podcast and had it in a piece of paper for 6 years, long before the podcast thing started to take off. And I was just, I was afraid. And a producer called me up and offered me a chance to go make a podcast. And I said to myself, well, you got to stop whining. You either got to make it or never make it. So I started making it. That was five seasons ago, not quite 5 years. So that's the Akimbo podcast. It has no guests. And I was just trying to play with the medium. It's fun to make. I make it back here in the foam covered shower in my home office. And I'll keep doing it as long as I'm getting pleasure out of it.
So, of course, you can go to akimbo.com and read this.
Oh, that's it. Akimbo.link. Akimbo.com.
Did I get there? Link.
And then one day I just emptied my pocketbook and bought akimbo.com for this other project.
Okay. So tell listeners, even though they can go read it themselves, what's the idea behind the word
akimbo? Akimbo is the way Wonder Woman stands with her arms on her hips or folded. Akimbo comes from the Norse. It is a bend in the river. And it means that when you bend something, you actually can make it stronger. And that what we get a chance to do when we approach the world is two things. We can stand arms akimbo, ready for action, but also we can bend the culture. And this culture of our lifetime, the last 20 years, has been bent by more people more often than any other culture in history. And we don't have to be victims. We have the chance to actually lead. And so I love the word, and I couldn't believe that I was able to acquire this. It's not my most valued possession, but it's certainly up there.
So do you feel that what you do or have done in your lifetime or your body of work falls into that category of bending culture?
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to do since 1977. The culture in 1977 was, how do I change the way 150 kids in Northern Canada think about themselves and where they're going next? That's a very small piece of culture. And bit by bit, project by project. I've been a teacher for the last 40 years. And the idea is pretty simple, which is if I can teach enough people who teach enough people who teach enough people, we're going to change things. And I'm super proud of the people I've taught and really proud of what they've built.
So the topics in Akimbo are all over the map. Would that be fair to say?
Well, we're talking about there's the Akimbo podcast and there's the Akimbo workshops. The Akimbo podcast
sure.
is designed in the following way. If you and I went on a 20-minute car ride and I said something interesting to you along the way, that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm trying to do it in a way that isn't timely, but that gets under your skin and helps you see the world a different way forever. That once you see it, you can't unsee it. That's a good episode of Akimbo.
So where do you birth those ideas?
Mostly in the shower, but the way I've done my work ever since permission marketing is pretty simple, which is even before that with the Fast Company columns. If I don't understand how something in the world works and it's working, that really bothers me. Why are people waiting in line to buy a t-shirt from Supreme? Why are people hoarding face masks? Why are people, you know, the culture doesn't happen without an explanation. It might seem random, but there better be a reason. And so my prompt is, why is it like that? And then I try to decode it. So there's a podcast I recorded last week of about modern monetary theory. Why do politicians say we have to balance the budget? They didn't used to say that, and some aren't saying it again. That's interesting, because clearly there's no fundamental law of economics, like there's a fundamental law of gravity, because smart people have completely changed their mind back and forth. Why? So I try to explain that.
So selfishly, I'd love to know how you produce your show. It is very high quality from a production standpoint. It clearly has, you know, breaks. It has lovely music. You have the call-in things. And I'm hoping you have a team of people that do this, but I'm wondering if it's you pulling a bunch of levers.
There's a woman named Alex DePalma, who's a podcast whisperer and a brilliant producer, but she does not do a lot of production on Akimbo. She and I spent a month going back and forth when I started, but I like being a freelancer when I'm freelancing. And so I do it with my own two fingers. I send her a finished podcast that is 96% done. How do I do it? I use a Zoom recorder and a good microphone with a preamp in a shower that's surrounded by foam core and moving blankets. And I do it in 1.2 takes. So a 20-minute episode, I will speak for 22 minutes. And then I go to use a piece of open source software called OCEN, O-C-E-N, that I pay for, and I edit it myself. And then she adds Davey's guitar riffs, which I licensed a couple years ago. And the call-in is done with something called SpeakPipe that's 10 or 20 bucks a month. And it's a very simple technology. So that's how I do it. I intentionally built a podcast that I didn't have to wait for a miracle for it to sound good. I knew I could do it. And if it takes more than that, I'm not going to add it in.
So your podcasts, I find them to be very well, very deeply researched. Of course, that may just be your personal interest in reading and the things that you cover. But do you batch them together? Do you do a month's worth and you're done? Or how? I'm curious how you do that because I...
Well,
they come off so natural.
Really nice of you. Between this and the production, you're making me blush a little. I like to be ahead. My blog is ahead. My podcast is ahead. Then I go back just the week before to make sure. I've gone as long as 2 weeks without making a podcast. In 1 week, I made four. And I'm not good on deadline. I don't like deadlines. They have the word dead in them. So I try to avoid those lines. In terms of deeply researched, they are not deeply researched at all. All of the data is in the show notes, and that's all I used. So sometimes I'll read a whole book, and then there'll be a podcast. But I didn't read the book to make a podcast. And
I was going to say, I think that's what I was hinting at. I think that that's just your natural sort of consumption.
Well, it is, but mostly, if I have ever asserted that I am giving a complete and accurate overview of anything, then I have made a mistake. That is not what I am doing. I am saying I might not be right, but at least this is interesting. And if you've got something to make me more right, I will correct myself. But I think there are fundamental precepts. You know, we know why CDs are 72 minutes long, and we know why pop music is 3.5 minutes long. There might be 100 reasons, but there's like one key thing there. And once you see that, you go, oh, well, that, so Twitter is the length Twitter is. And so that's really fascinating to me. But maybe it's not fascinating to you. And the good news, it's free and there's another one.
So I said I wasn't going to talk much about books today, but I listened. I had about an 8-hour car ride, and I listened to Malcolm Gladwell's latest book on audio. And it struck me, in his own admission, that he meant it to strike me this way as right. a produced podcast. And I'm wondering if is that the future of audiobooks?
I liked it, but it wasn't here nor there. And so this is the problem, and this is why Akimbo, I felt, needed to be made with my own two hands. Because once you've heard This American Life, and once you've heard what it really means to produce a radio show, you got to beat that if you're going to make something you're going to sell, right? Whereas if I'm writing my blog, it's my two fingers. I typed it myself. If I'm making my podcast, here I am. It's me. You're getting intimacy in exchange for production value. And I've always felt this about websites, about movies. You know, if you look at the science fiction movies from the 50s, the reason they don't work is they are neither homemade nor professional. And as soon as George Lucas figured out how to make a science fiction movie that's professional, now you've either got to make one at least as good as Star Wars or obviously handmade. But and like the Wachowskis and The Matrix was so powerful because it was better than Ultraman by so much. And so for me, as a consumer of the media, Malcolm's production got in the way because I was like, oh, I get it. But that interview you did with that general, it doesn't sound as good. You could have just called him from a different phone. And that took me completely out of it. Whereas if he just described to me the phone call, I would have been back in it. And that's the beauty of it. And so, you know, with my publisher, the book I did Your Turn, I designed it myself. But all my other books look just like books, because even though we could add stuff, it wouldn't make it better. It would make it worse.
I want to talk about relevance. You and I were talking before we got on air. You're one of the few people I interviewed who's been doing this longer than me. So we got to commiserate about that a little bit. And I wonder, do you ever think about the idea of relevance? I mean, a lot of people, especially in a technology world and things, you know, it's like, how do you stay relevant? I get that question a lot. Do you ever think about relevance, or does it just come from thinking about something else?
Well, I'm going to interpret what you mean by relevance, meaning as an Altacocker old person, do I have anything useful to say to the current conversation? You know, when Photoshop got to Photoshop 4, I realized understanding alpha channels and using them was going to be beyond my abilities. Or I could give up a whole bunch of other things, up to me. So since that day, I have not had anything relevant to say about the state of Photoshop. You got to opt out, right? And so the way I deal with that is by going to a new field. So I helped invent email marketing, but now there's stuff about email marketing that I just can't contribute to because I haven't been in it. I was on the web before there were websites, right? But I can't speak intelligently about the fundamentals of SEO because I'm not in it. So I have defined my relevant area as slightly ahead of the uneducated masses, talking about strategy as opposed to deep in it with the informed technorati talking about tactics, because I can't do that.
So, and if it wasn't obvious, I was suggesting that you are.
Well, I don't care about, you know, part of the price of living on the frontier that I've chosen to live on is I'm going to be wrong a whole bunch of times. And I'm okay with being wrong as long as I'm not being mean and as long as I fix it. And, you know, when I dismissed the World Wide Web in 1993 and a half, 1994, as a flash in the pan. That cost me $40 billion. So I've lost more money being wrong than most people. And but I think most people who follow my work are glad that I keep trying, because I still open doors now and then, and that's my job.
You know, today content is everything. So our websites are really content management systems, but they've got to work like one. Check out Zephr. It is a modern cloud-based CMS system that's licensed only to agencies. It's really easy to use. It's very fast. Won't mess with your SEO. I mean, it really reduces the time and effort to launch your clients' websites. Beautiful themes, just really fast, profitable way to go. They include an agency services to really kind of make them your plug-and-play dev shop. Check out Zephr.com. That is Zephyrcms.com. So let's talk about the Akimbo workshops. And I don't know if this fits into the Akimbo workshops, but the first one, I guess, is Alt-MBA.
So the Alt-MBA, the idea 5 years ago was, I read that 97% of the people who took the AI MOOC, 100,000 people took it, 3,000 people finished it. It's a 97% dropout rate. And that was considered excellent. And since then, the dropout rate for MOOCs has gotten worse. Try to imagine an institution where 100 people show up for class, and at the end of the course, there are 3 people in the front row. We would shut it down, right? So I'm like, well, why is that? Yeah. And what can I do as an example to help shake this field up? Because I believe in learning. And so I sat down and I invented the Alt-MBA to do the opposite of what almost every online course does. No videos, no tests, no certificate. It's not free. And there's an enormous amount of peer-to-peer work with small group coaching. The opposite. And we have a 97% completion rate, a 3% dropout rate. And we have people in 78 countries and we've changed their lives. But it's not cheap. And so I was like, well, how do I do this in tactical areas where we can use slightly different technology, do it asynchronously at a larger scale? And so we have the We have the Story Skills Workshop, which launches as you and I are talking this week. We have the Marketing Seminar, the Creatives Workshop, the Bootstrappers Workshop, and on and on. Each one designed to attract 1,000 or 2,000 people who want to come together and actually do work. And there are videos in those, but not like on Masterclass. And the people who are in this space look at what we are doing when I show it to them behind the scenes, and their jaws drop, because we purpose built it not to be popular, but to be transformative. And my plan was run the Alt-MBA twice, prove it works, and then set it out there as an example. And now we're up to the 40th one. We have 100 coaches around the world, because if it works this well, how can I walk away from it? So now it's mostly an obligation.
So you mentioned coaches. You're also partnering, I think, on Story Skills with Bernadette Jiwa. Is that a model that just fell in your lap, or is that a model that you're pursuing to actually have kind of other area experts?
Right. So we have that one. We have Podcasting Fellowship, which I do with Alex DePalma, who produces my podcast. There are two of our most successful ones, which is fine for my ego. And it is tempting to think of ourselves as a publisher. The challenge we have is whoever we work with has to be willing to do it our way, their content, but our structure. And so we're not killing ourselves looking for the next instructor. But if someone with a body of work shows up who has a following, we're totally delighted to figure out how to make that work.
Well, Bernadette's been on this show before as well. And I think that I may.
Well, we would love to have you as our guest. Just drop me a note and I'll set you up.
Well, I can never stop learning. Let's talk about conferences. Are they done?
The froth is gone for a really, really long time. So the evolution feels to me like this. Mark Twain started as the first professional speaker in the U.S. And the math of hiring Mark Twain was there was no way to get any Mark Twain without going to see him in person. It's worth $5. A whole bunch of people comes to the room. Mark's happy. The promoter's happy. Then business conferences started, and those require a trip to Orlando, a horrible hotel, bad food, and and on and on. Well, if you're spending all that money, spending 5% of it for a speaker is nothing. And so the race was on not to get good speakers, but famous speakers who give status to the organization. Because if you can say to the crowd, you're important enough that I'm dragging in a living ex-president, the crowd feels good about themselves and it justifies part of the trip. Well, this led to more froth on top of more froth on top of more froth, because once a conference is up and running, it's hard to say I'm not going anymore, and easy to say, oh, I got to go again this year. And now we have this forced interruption, and people are going to relook both at personal safety, but mostly at value for time spent. And so a whole bunch of conferences that were not bad are going to go away forever. Because if you're going to, it's like tuna in your sushi. You shouldn't eat tuna and sushi ever, but if you're gonna, it should be a really good piece of sushi. And so I think that some conferences that are run properly and beautifully and that make people cry, those deserve to last, and they probably will. I think certain industries have trade shows that will survive. But the idea that an impresario can make seven figures putting together an event for 3 days, I don't know. And as someone who gave 1,000 speeches at conferences, I loved being on stage. I hated every other element of it, but I loved being on stage. So I kept going because it's a way to do my craft and then be off duty and to touch people. But what I learned from these Akimbo workshops, more people have been changed more deeply by the workshops I'm not actively in live than have ever been changed by me being on stage. And so I'm saying to people who want me to come for the foreseeable future, sorry, I'm here to help, but I can help better doing this.
Yeah. And I wonder, when I hear you talk about, you know, want to attend events that make them cry, I mean, I think increasingly that's going to be 25 people, 50 people, you know, not 5,000.
Well, it is possible to run a 5,000 person event that is transformative. You know, I remember when Bill and Alan started Fast Company, I don't know why they invited me, but I went to the first four advances they held, which were like retreats, but going forward. And several of my best friends in the world are my best friends because I met them there. And that was 300 people, right? And a good TED conference is worth the trip. The problem is not all TED conferences are good ones. And it's hard to tell in advance before you go. But what we're going to have to do, and this is the shift that everyone has been fighting, watching someone from the seats of an auditorium doesn't count. That like, you can do that for an hour. You can't do it for eight. You're going to have to do the gutsy thing of making connection happen. And what Zoom taught us is space and time are no longer the driving factors. It's guts. Who has the emotional effort and labor to look someone in the eye and tell them the truth? And if we can figure out how to have that happen in real life, bring it on. But it's already happening in digital. And there are forces that are fighting to make it feel like real life, forcing us to sit there and just take notes at a meeting online, which is stupid. And I'm hopeful that we'll use the interruption to say, wait a minute, there's a lot to do. Let's get personal.
So I am working on my next book. And
your last one was a really big leap, and you should be really proud of it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And it was a big leap. this one will be a combination of leaps, I think, drawing from my early work with maybe what I've learned over the last couple of years too. But my question in this is, it's certainly, I can't imagine anything being done right now that's not being colored by right now. And, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, in the traditional book publishing world, when this thing comes out in like 8 years, you know, what a book is going to mean, you know, at that point. I mean, there's, you know, the statistics way better than me because I hear you quote them all the time, of how many books are being produced, you know, on a yearly basis. You know, what does it take for a book to actually break through? And is it just purely audience, or is it an idea?
Just for the viewers at home, since we've been talking, 40 books have been published. Right? It's every hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There isn't a book shortage. There will never again be a book shortage. That's not what books are for. Sean Coyne has pointed out that the author and the publisher have a job. Sell the first 10,000 copies. Right. After that, the book has a job. and the book's job is sell the next million copies. And if a book doesn't do that after you've done your job, the book needed to be better. And so the purpose of a book is it is a contained, maybe digital, probably not, device that stands the test of time that person A can give to person B. They gain status and they give status by having that transaction. We can't do that with most other things. And the thing about self-published books is just like traditionally published books, a lot of them aren't very good. And what the public has figured out is it doesn't matter who publishes a book. It matters that it changed you. And, you know, I mentioned Ben and Roz Zander's book on my blog last week, and more than 1,000 copies were purchased from one blog post from a book that was written 20 years ago. And my friend Jacqueline Novogratz has written a book, and her book has reached thousands of people. That's not enough,
right?
But it's entirely possible that those thousands of people will tell thousands of people. And if they do...
So it says, why don't you tell people, if you don't mind, where they might find out more about your upcoming workshops and get on your list. I know you have waiting list for them and whatnot, where they can at least do some reading and research.
We'd love to have you. It's at altmba.com is the big one. And then the rest are at akimbo.com. And if you'd rather just read 7,482 blog posts, they're at seth.blog.
Awesome.
But I just keep making stuff because no one's charging me to make it. And I'll just keep putting it in the world as long as people want it. So it's a privilege. I can't believe I get to do this. And I'm so lucky to know you. Seven times a charm. I think I'm finally getting this podcasting thing right with you. So thank you for letting me cry again.
Well, Seth, always a pleasure to have you on. And hopefully we'll be able to run into you when we're back out there on the road again.
Thank you, John.